neck, actually, in the gymnasium. Very foolish, it was my own mistake. And I was offered a place at Leigh Court, and I came here in April 1974, and I've never regretted it. Because during its evolution, some very wise people, at every level, have insisted that perhaps the customer is right, and that the customer and the consumer should always be involved and consulted, and that perhaps, just perhaps, the human beings might like living their own lives and not having somebody else live it for them.
And that's where all too often we go wrong in providing for the disabled. We forget how very important our independence and self-respect. Most disabled people do not want to be treated as special cases. Their greatest and very normal desire is to live as far as possible ordinary lives within the community. In this second report on the disabled, we look at the bad news, the way so many factors still combine to make many of the 3 million impaired people in Britain second-class citizens. Alfred Morris's Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act of 1970, the first and only piece of legislation specifically for the disabled, has gone some way to improving the situation. But as we shall see, it's one thing for an act to recommend certain provisions, and quite another thing for them to be actually carried out. The biggest problem for the disabled is the simple one of money. The 1970 Act paved the way for the introduction of attendance allowances and invalidity benefits. But the situation is by no means satisfactory, as David Price, MP for the Eastleigh Division of Hampshire, tells us.
The first need, of course, is financial. And put very, very simply, disability, serious disability, means loss of earnings. Also, on the other side of the balance sheet, disability means extra costs. And disability means severe restrictions, hence, in the quality of life. It's reckoned by the professionals in this field that there are well over 1 million people so severely disabled that this is a major problem. And of those, the vast majority are living near to the poverty margin, that is to say, the supplementary benefit margin. Now, I believe that what we need is a national disability income. You see, at the moment, although there's been considerable improvement in the benefits, financial benefits available to seriously disabled people, they are on a go-no-go basis. Either you get it or you don't. You see, at the moment, the whole question of financial benefits is an absolute jungle, depending not on your condition, but how you incurred it.
So, what does happen at the moment? Peter Corshay, himself severely disabled, attempts to explain the existing jungle of benefits.
If you work and you've paid your national insurance, if you become sick during your working life, then you get a thing called invalidity benefit. If you become injured at work, because of your work, you can get industrial injuries benefit. Now, if you become disabled, say you're born disabled, or you become disabled before you reach working age, in other words, you've never contributed to the national insurance scheme, then there is no way that you can get any worthwhile finances apart from supplementary benefit. Now, the Disablement Income Group pressed the government over a number of years to try to recognise this difference, and the result was that a thing called the non-contributory invalidity pension was created. But this is only a sort of a token financial award, and the rest is made up with supplementary benefit to bring you up to the same level as you would have been if you were only on supplementary benefit. This is the great problem, I think. What I think I'd like to see happen is that the government combine all the little awards that you can get, which are spread over all sorts of different offices at different parts of the country, and combine the whole lot and call it the disability pension.
So, both David Price and Peter Corshay, and indeed the vast majority of those concerned with the disabled, agree there should be one good-sized allowance, not dependent on how you become disabled, instead of lots of little ones. Getting enough money from the state is vitally important, because all too often disability means loss of earnings. Legally, firms must have 3% of their employees as registered disabled, but there are problems. Some companies employ their 3%, but give them menial jobs to do, such as blind people measuring out lengths of cable all day. There are other problems, as Mr. Humphreys, Divisional Director of South East Hampshire Social Services, explains.
And this is one of the controversial issues which arises from time to time is the extent to which employers employ the right percentage of disabled people. And one of the problems there is that individuals have a lot of pride and they're very conscious of being formally registered as disabled unless there is a very good reason for them to be so registered. And if they can find employment and hold a job down, even though they may be entitled to be registered, they don't necessarily choose to be so.
In other words, it's the stigma, real or imaginary, of the green card issued to registered disabled. This problem dogs the efforts of the craft and manufacturing industries set up to train and employ seriously disabled people on a full working wage with industrial benefits and trade union representation. There's one in Portsmouth with some vacancies that could be filled if more people registered and applied. But finance isn't the only answer to all the problems, as Pat Saunders explains.
We have to a certain extent to re-educate the community to accept this point of view that disabled people are not ill and that disabled people are not anything particular. In other words, disablement strikes right through the whole social strata. You are not necessarily poor because you're disabled. You can be a disabled millionaire. By the same token, because you're disabled, you don't necessarily not pay rates or not pay income tax. You are, and for this reason, you are therefore entitled to your fair share of what society has to offer, whether it is transport, education, or the ability to get in and out of the town hall. It matters not.
So, for the disabled to become integrated within the community, to get their fair share of what society has to offer, that community, that society, in fact we, the general public, have to rethink our whole attitude towards them. This is how David Price puts it.
Now, stage one is where a shopping centre puts on a special evening for disabled people. That is entirely to be welcome, which is only stage one. Stage two is when that shopping centre is so laid out that a person in a wheelchair, for example, or a blind person, can perfectly well go and shop there in the normal shopping hours and provide no embarrassment either to the disabled shopper or to the authorities or to the other shoppers. Now, if you take the theatres, when the Festival Hall was first opened, they very well produced a certain part of the Festival Hall for people in wheelchairs. Now, this was in those days quite pioneering, entirely to be welcome. That was only stage one. Stage two is when the person in the wheelchair can be so placed with their normal friends and family that they're not segregated. And this is the whole emphasis must be on getting away from what I might call the disabled ghetto.
The kind of stage two total integration that David Price wants to see is largely dependent upon architectural design. So I asked Jim Powell, architect and reader in building utility at Portsmouth Polytechnic, whether he thought such a vision was possible in these terms.
Well, I think it's totally unrealistic to consider complete integration within the community for wheelchair cases, because the costs involved in creating environments that would give total flexibility to all the disabled, I think would be absolutely astronomical. I think it's perfectly possible to create environments that are relatively barrier-free to the disabled, and especially the wheelchair users, for only a little extra cost, as long as we're prepared to spend time at the design stage thinking about the wheelchair user, then for only a small extra cost we will be able to create environments that were much less barrier ridden. But to go the stage further and say that the wheelchair user would have total freedom within any environment would require so many design changes, would require so much extra design, as it were, that I don't think we as a society could afford to create such totally free environments, as much as I would like.
So, perhaps total integration isn't on, but things still could be a lot better. One of the sections in the 1970 Act requires all public buildings to provide access and parking for the disabled. A study done by a sixth-year student of Portsmouth School of Architecture looked at seven public buildings built since 1970 in Portsmouth to see if they met these requirements. Among them were the Central Library and the new civic offices. Things could have been a lot better, as Jim Powell explains.
The sort of thing he noticed in nearly all the buildings, even one specifically designed for the disabled, were simple things like the doors were just too heavy for the wheelchair user to push open. Car parks were at an excessive distance from the entrances to buildings, too far often for the disabled person to walk just the distance. Light switches and lift buttons were just far too high for the wheelchair user to reach. And the old joke about only being able to go to the third floor and not the top floor is very realistic. And also the lifts in many of the public buildings were so small that the wheelchair user just couldn't go in and turn his wheelchair around. He had to go in forwards and reverse out. On another track, the use of ramps. Obviously, designers had considered ramps very carefully in their design of buildings, but the ramps were often so long from start to finish that you almost had to be an Olympic arm wrestler to be able to force your wheelchair up from the bottom to the top. There were no breaks at intermediate levels to give the wheelchair user a rest. These buildings that Erlingwist looked at were all public buildings. Public in the sense that they should allow everyone access to them. And clearly these simple faults were preventing disabled people, especially wheelchair users, getting into them.
It's relatively simple design faults which make life so difficult for the disabled, as Pat Saunders explains.
There are many problems with access. The simplest ones, of course, are those of the problems of getting wheelchairs through doors. But many problems are those which could have been solved so easily in the building of a structure. For instance, swing doors, which require two people to keep them open to allow a wheelchair to go through. That's three people in all, including the pusher. Whereas the doors could have been built with a 10-second delay, which you would open the door and it would stay open while you went through. Problems with switches, which you can't be reached. For the partially sighted, it is much easier to walk around a room which is correctly coloured with sharp contrast rather than being drab.
How about cars?
Yes, the big one with cars, of course, is the fact that whilst we have disabled parking spaces, they should be a car and a half wide to allow for the wheelchair, and they never seem to do this. Several things connected with lifts, particularly for the blind, where the buttons should be tactile, that is, the blind man should be able to feel which floor he's on, which button he's using by the surface of it. Secondly, there should be a sound system telling the blind man which floor he's on. And from my point of view as a wheelchair jockey, the button should be low enough to reach from the wheelchair.
Peter Corshay, though severely disabled, will be getting married soon and moving from a residential home to his own house. He makes the point that it isn't only public buildings which could be better designed.
A great deal of the buildings that we, the able-bodied people live in, are by no means suitable from the access point of view for disabled people. Doors are just not wide enough for wheelchairs. There are steps in the way, and you have to either to make the doors wider and provide ramps, or maybe if you can stand up, you need a rail to hold onto in your bathroom or your loo. If you are severely disabled and you're very heavy, then sometimes you can have the provision of an electric hoist which runs on a rail, which can be fixed into the wall, which of course is very, very useful to move you without any difficulty whatsoever. There may be sort of things like if you are a disabled housewife, for instance, you may find that your kitchen may have to be adapted severely, that your worktops are down at a reasonable height, your electric switches, sockets, etc., or have to be in a reachable condition, a reachable position. These are the kind of things that may be necessary in one's own home.
Designers, then, could do an awful lot more to help integration. And it's not just for the wheelchair user, a point Jim Powell is at pains to point out.
It's often considered, if you're talking about disabled, that you design for the wheelchair user. because there's a quantity you know, the reach of the from the wheelchair, and the actual dimensions of the wheelchair are a very known quantity. Someone with a crippling disease that is partly ambulant, then his precise movements are much more difficult to understand and design for. But I think they have to be designed for, and this is where I'd like to see the architect having greater involvement. Simple little things I think the architect could do. He could provide automatically opening doors. I know they are quite expensive, but this could be done. He can provide light switches at the right height so they can be reached, and sockets sufficiently far off the floor that it's easy for the disabled, for the arthritic, to plug the plugs in. Light switches themselves, I think, for the people who have trouble, in fact, manipulating the small toggle switches, there are rocker type switch mechanisms which require very little control over finger movements to be able to turn a light on and off. Now, clearly, at the moment, such devices are relatively expensive because they are produced only in small quantities. But if enough pressure came on from the designer, then there would undoubtedly be the normal economies of scale, which would lead to cheaper rocker-type switch mechanisms. And it's this sort of pressure that is needed to ensure that we come up with designs that are cheap and good.
And even though, for instance, automatically opening doors may cost £500 at the moment, these and other aids to the handicapped, special telephones for the deaf, electrically operated hoists and possum life support machines are all in the end money savers, because they make greater independence possible and cut the cost of long stay hospitalisation or someone paid to be in constant attendance. The sad fact is that however well-intentioned designers and politicians are, it requires an imaginative response from the administrators who carry out policy, in most cases the local city councillors. John Perry is a 33-year-old qualified welder who now has a very serious heart condition. He is one of those who, through pride and self-respect, however misguided, has not registered as disabled. He's still in full employment in a sedentary job in the dockyard. The point about John is that on medical grounds, he's been recommended for a ground floor flat. But listen to where he lives. Guy Payne sets the scene.
At the moment you live in a fourth floor flat.
Yeah.
In Grafton Street in Buckland. How do you get to that flat?
Well, there's a lift working when there's one working, otherwise you have found the stairs, in fact.
What happened during the lift engineer strike?
I found the stairs, in fact.
And during the power cuts?
The same.
How many steps?
72, in fact.
72.
Yes.
How long does it take you?
Roughly about an hour.
2 hours a day climbing up and down stairs seems downright dangerous for someone with a serious heart condition. However, Councillor Wakefield, chairman of the Housing Committee in Portsmouth, told me that it was City Council policy to regard any flat with a lift as being equivalent to a ground floor flat. Indeed, he said that there was no possibility of this policy being changed in the foreseeable future. I asked Mrs. Perry, John's wife, if she thought that was a reasonable policy.
No, I don't. Say the lift breaks down, and in my husband's condition and Mr. Cornish, they get down there, and they're going to get back up again.
Well, one thing Mr. Wakefield told me was that there was a 24-hour emergency service when there was no lift working. Is that true?
Well, I've never known that to work. I mean, I've known for two to be broken down at a time and had to walk upstairs.
So what have you done about this?
I've complained to the council. And what do? They don't answer your letters even.
So you did apply for a transfer, didn't you?
Yes.
How long have you been waiting?
I applied for a transfer last October. I had somebody from the housing department and he said it was granted. And I had a letter from Lombard Street to say that it was all granted on medical grounds.
And how long have you been waiting now?
Well, the next thing I'll get was a letter to say that it was turned down because Mr. Kirby said he's got to walk up the stairs.
So what have you done since then?
Well, since then, I've been in touch with Mr. Frank Judney MP, and he is trying to help us get a transfer.
Mrs. Cornish, your husband's disabled as well, I believe.
Yes.
What is his disability?
Chronic bronchitis and emphysema of the lungs.
And I believe you want a transfer as well.
Yes, I put in for a transfer through my husband's health after he came out of Benetton Chest Hospital because the doctor said that he must have a ground floor flat. Even with the lift, as they consider it, a first floor flat, the doctor said if he got down to the stairs, he couldn't walk up.
So I believe now you're in fact taking the council to court. Now, why is this?
Well, I've been waiting a year and 3 months for a transfer from this place, and it's been a long time coming, and then all this dampness appeared, which was no good to my husband. He was taken into the Royal Portsmouth Hospital because of this dampness, and his doctor said that he didn't like the idea of him coming back into it, as this dampness is in every room in the house.
What did the council do when you said that it was damp?
We've had numerous council officials to the home, and over my wall in the sitting room, they knocked 3 holes in the wall, and they also brought along a plasterer with them to plaster it up behind him. And then they told us that we would have to, it would come through all the time, it wouldn't be clear. So they suggested that the only thing to keep it clear would be to wash it down, to get out and keep it washed down.
Well, that sounds a bit strange. So, in fact, you are taking them to court, aren't you?
Yes.
We can't really say very much about that because the case hasn't come up.
No.
But how has it affected your application for transfer?
Well, my application for transfer is quite all right. All my husband's certificates from Benetton Chest Hospital, his doctor, all went down to their doctor in Lombard Street, and he wrote back to the council and told them that I was to have a transfer, and it was to be a ground floor, bottom flat. Now, I even wrote to the Lord Mayor, and I asked him if there was some way that he could help us to rush this business through because of my husband's health, and he wrote me a very nice letter and said that he'd written to Mr. Kirby to see if something couldn't be done to hurry it on. Well, nothing's come of it. And I've been to the numerous councillors, and they said they would see. I've not heard anything from that. In fact, my opinion is they just don't want to know.
A sad state of affairs indeed. Frank Judd, the MP for Portsmouth North, has some comments to make on this particular case. But what he says applies all too often to the general attitude of those dealing with the disabled.
I don't underestimate at all the problems with which the housing department is grappling. What I believe we've got to recognise is that it's not the officials in the housing department who are to blame, it's the overall political policy of the city that matters. And that's the responsibility of the city council. And what I think the city council's got to demonstrate in its housing policy is a good deal more imaginative humanity. We know that a lift isn't 100% reliable. So you can't say to a person who's got a serious heart condition, well, look, you must be satisfied with being on the fourth or the eighth or whatever it is floor because you've got a lift. You know that on some occasions that lift won't be working. And if I had my way, we would see, for example, the city councillors calling in not only the housing experts, but medical people, social workers and the others, and having a total rethink about their priorities in the housing policy, about the way, the criteria they use to decide who should be in what accommodation, where. We need much more imaginative flexibility.
Imaginative flexibility, that seems to be the key. In this second victory report on the disabled, we've looked at the bad news, the way finance, design and attitudes still leave a lot to be desired. And my thanks are due to Guy Payne, who did much of the interviewing and research for this report. The message that comes through loud and strong again and again in these programmes is that disabled people want their independence and their self-respect, and the only way they can keep that is to live as normal lives as possible within the community. It's up to those of us who are not disabled to help them achieve their aims.